Ladies and gentlemen, jury, the prosecution is not going to get that man today. No, because I'm going to get him.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this episode of the Hagman and Hagman Report. We're coming to you live from our radio and television studios here in beautiful Northwest Pennsylvania. That's right, it's a balmy, 52 degrees out there over cloudy skies. That's right, it's a weather forecast, too. Now, folks, I'm just giving you the State of the Union as it stands weather-wise. This is the first day of spring, isn't it, Joe? I don't know.
Yesterday was the first day, but either way,
it's spring has sprung, and folks, we're so glad to be coming, be broadcasting right here on the Global Star Radio Network. We broadcast Monday night, or every weeknight, Monday through Friday, 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Again, right here on the Global Star Satellite Radio Network, as well as our good friends at BTR, Blog Talk Radio, and YouTube Live. That's right, three venues. Listening live right now, upwards of 42 countries. Last year alone, 117 countries, 78.25 million downloads. So proud that you have the belief and trust in us as we walk through the minefield of current events headlines together. Don't forget, folks, we've got two separate websites, actually three now, but the program website, HagmanandHagman.com. There you can watch the program live, listen to it live, all of the different segments, and also HagmanReport.com there for news information analysis, and of course HomelandSecurityUS.com. That's my personal website initiative, of course, and that's to bring you the undercover operational, that's a public portal of the operational work that we do to expose what we can in terms of the infiltration here in our country of people that are really against the Constitution of the United States. At least that's how we see it. And of course, I'm Doug Hagman at the helm, fellow investigator, researcher, co-host Joe Hagman, my son. Together we are the Hagman and Hagman Report. So proud to have our really a very interesting man, a man that again has garnered my respect for a number of reasons, not the least of which he's actually from where we sit right now, where our studio is located, Erie, Pennsylvania. His name is Joseph Pistone, and he's a legend. He's a man who deserves, in my view, everyone's respect for his undercover FBI investigative efforts, accomplishments, and for really cleaning up a lot of things, and for having the guts and the courage to do what he has done. Certainly well deserving of our respect. Before we get to our guest, I want to mention that portions of tonight's broadcast brought to you by Policy Genius. I don't know how many of you out there don't have life insurance. Folks, if you don't, now is the time to get it. You know, it's estimated that in the neighborhood of 35 million U.S. families have no life insurance at all, zero. That's 30% of U.S. households. Folks, don't put off getting life insurance. I could tell you stories about friends of mine who did, and a couple of them actually, and it's needless pain and suffering for the families. That's why there's policygenius.com, P-O-L-I-C-Y, genius.com, policygenius.com. That is the place to go to save over 40% off of other prices for life insurance. Policygenius.com. More on that later. But Joe, I'm going to bring you, Joe, on, and then we're going to bring our guest on. And this is, folks, buckle up, because this is going to be a great program.
Yeah, great to be here. Really looking forward to tonight's show. Talk about somebody who, as an undercover FBI agent, infiltrated the mafia more so and got further than anybody really in the history, and brought down just a whole host of criminal organizations, really. And it's a fascinating story. And without further ado, let's bring on Mr. Pistone. Welcome to the Hagman Report.
Well, thank you for having me on. And I guess it's kind of cold up there, huh, boys?
Not too bad today, but yeah.
Well, it depends. See, yeah, 52 is not too bad for us, considering, you know, it's...
Yeah, well, 52, people. That's right. You guys are probably out in T-shirts and shorts.
You got that right.
I can remember living there, man. What, are you kidding?
Well, you know, your name came up. Your name came up. I was talking with a municipal court judge earlier today. We had a conversation about you. He knows of you. He doesn't know you, of course. Folks, we're talking with Joe Dominic Pistone, alias Donnie Brasco. That's perhaps how you might know him. And we share something in common, and that commonality is the fact that we are from Erie, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I learned that today.
Joe, you were born here in Erie, right?
Well, I actually was born in another part of the state, but I spent a lot of my young years growing up going to school in Erie, yeah.
Okay. And yeah, so I mean, we've got some things in common, but and in fact, I've got a question I'll ask you later about. Well, and I'm not sure if you even want to answer it, but how you picked up the name, your last name, your last your surname, undercover surname, if that has any connection to this town, but
no, it has the.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. All right. Well.
Fair enough.
You believe me, that's where we're going to leave it. yes. But okay. So the reason that we're so glad to have you on, and the reason that your story is just such an incredible story. You were born in 1939. Of course, what am I doing telling you this? But your undercover work for the FBI. You spent 6 years, of course, infiltrating the Bonanno crime family. And I think everyone knows you like that. So if you just kind of want to give us a little bit about yourself, tell us a little bit about yourself, wherever you want to start, and we'll just pick it up from there conversationally.
Well, you know, I spent younger years in Erie. I went to Perry and Roosevelt, those two schools. And then I moved just before high school and moved to Patterson, which I had, my family had lived there, and then moved back to Erie and then moved back to Patterson, Patterson, New Jersey. And I was a ball player. I played basketball, football, but mostly basketball. That was my sport. And went to Staunton Military Academy, Staunton, Virginia. Played basketball there, and then had a few offers to play basketball. And I went back to New Jersey. The Staunton Military Academy's in Staunton, Virginia, and I went to William Patterson University, and I played. 3 years of basketball there, and then I got married, so I didn't play ball my senior year. And in my senior year, I took the I always wanted to be in law enforcement. I always wanted to be a police officer. And in my senior year, I took the exam for the Passaic County Park Police, and I passed it. And was due to get appointed, and they told me that. I couldn't complete my last year of college because I had to go to the police academy. Well, I wasn't going to give up 4 years of college, and so I didn't. I stayed on, and when I graduated, I applied for Naval Intelligence, and while they were doing all my background and everything, I took a job in the Patterson School District, and I taught social studies for a year until I got appointed to the Office of Naval Intelligence. experience. I was assigned to the Philadelphia Naval Yard, and I got to know a lot of FBI agents and worked with the FBI. And I guess I got recruited by the FBI and took the test for the FBI and was fortunate enough to pass. And it was the greatest decision I ever made. I mean, you know, because like I knew I was going to be in law enforcement one way or another.
Right.
And I figured, well, they're the premier law enforcement agency. So after my 2 years with Naval Intelligence, I got appointed a special agent with the FBI. Went to Quantico, did my, I think it was 16 weeks back then.
Right.
And my first office out of training school was Jacksonville, Florida.
Okay, I just wanted to just kind of interject something here. Back when you became an FBI, you joined the FBI in 1969, is that right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this was during the time of J. Edgar Hoover.
Yes, it was.
Yeah. And Mr. Passone, that was a whole different FBI than it is today, right? I mean, back then it was...
That was,
well,
I'll tell you, the years I worked under Mr. Hoover were some of the best years of my years in the FBI.
I can imagine.
He ran a straight as an arrow organization, and you know, I just was just very proud of my years working under Mr. Hoover. You know,
well,
there was
yeah.
no we didn't bow to political pressure from either side. And everybody had rules, and you followed the rules, and if you broke the rules, you know, you knew you were going to get
the
gigged.
Price.
And that's
right.
The way it was.
Yeah, and I was just thinking about this, the difference between today, and I won't dwell on this, but the difference between back then when you were an agent, when you were hired, you know, knowing that J. Edgar Hoover ran a tight ship, despite whatever, the fact that he had, I mean, I've always believed this, that he always wrote in blue ink, and the reason I bring that up is because of just the structure of the FBI as opposed to today. And of course, so you, in my view, you were trained, this is again my personal opinion, you were trained with by the best and became the best, and that enabled you to do what you did, because despite whatever what anyone might think of J. Edgar Hoover personally, I do believe that the structure of the FBI was such that he turned out some great agents, and you were one.
You're exactly right. I agree with you 100%. And you know, he made the FBI the premier law enforcement agency in the world, not the country, in the world. I mean, every major law enforcement agency throughout the world respects the FBI. I mean, he developed one of the best crime labs in the world. He developed the National Academy. What that is that they bring in police officers from the United States and other countries, and they complete a 14-week. It's either 14 or 16 week training session at the FBI Academy, where they're and this 16 week training is accredited with the University of Virginia. So you know, he just developed so many good programs that are still carried on today. And I think the best, you know, one of the best things is that in those days, in the early days, the structure was there. And, you know, look, let's face it, law enforcement agencies are paramilitary. You know, you have to be run in an orderly fashion. And that's what he did, and
boy,
a again, you know, it's considered the premier law enforcement agency in the world. And I hope that it, you know, I hope that people, you know, start to come around and think of it that way again, although, you know, we're getting kind of knocked the last couple of years or so, but, you know.
Yeah, to say the least. Yeah. I often, when I was thinking about you today and prior to the program, my son Joe and I were talking, and we were just wondering how, number one, how J. Edgar Hoover would look back at the organization if he were alive today to see its current state. And then we were also talking.
Well, there wouldn't be so many leaks, I can tell you that.
Yeah.
Wherever all these leaks are coming from, he'd make sure that they'd get plugged quick, believe me.
Exactly. And then Joe and I were talking about too, the changes that you must have witnessed, you know, that perhaps you might reflect on at later in the interview about the changes in the FBI. Of course, we touched on that, but nonetheless. So you went to the office, or you were involved in the, you took a position at the Office of the Naval Intelligence. And then, of course, you joined the FBI in 1969. And you were ultimately transferred, it's my understanding, to New York in 1974. And folks, think of 1974 New York. I was a young man back then, okay? But I remember New York. I remember it being a rough and tumble, man, hijackings, truck hijackings. I mean, it was a pretty...
The mob ran New York, let's put it that way.
There you go.
I mean,
there you
New
so,
York
so,
was
yeah.
a little bit short of the Wild West.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So tell us, after your transfer to New York, tell us, you got to New York, the FBI. I mean, I know you went to Jacksonville first, and then, right? So was it because of your experience with the 18-wheelers and bulldozers and such, and the fact that New York had such a problem with truck hijackings that you were transferred up there? Or what happened after you transferred?
Well, what happened, basically, you know, just to back up a little bit, when I was in Jacksonville, you know, Jacksonville was not too far from being a Wild West either back then. I mean, if you know anything about Jacksonville, Florida, back in the days, there's a lot of not mafia gangsters, but you know, a lot of bad guys, a lot of bank burglars, bank robbers, a lot of crime. And I got involved there doing some undercover work, infiltrating gambling dens and buying stolen property, buying stolen art, et cetera, et cetera. So that's when I started to do some of my undercover work. And then I actually got transferred to Alexandria, Virginia, before New York. And at the time, there wasn't any real undercover program in the FBI. It was just maybe 20, 25 guys throughout the country that were doing undercover operations, and none of them were long term. They may be, you know, what we call a buy bust. The undercover agent gets introduced to the bad guy, makes a deal, and once the deal is consummated, you arrest them. Or, you know, the operation might go a week, a couple weeks, but there was nothing real long term. And I got involved in the same type of undercover operations in the Virginia, Washington, D.C. area. And then there was an undercover operation going out of Florida where they had a group of thieves that were stealing high-priced automobiles. They stole tractor trailers. And everything was made to order. You went to them and said, look, I want a Mercedes. Okay, what color you want? What interior you want? You know, what are all the bells and whistles you want on it? And they would go out and go to the car lot and steal it. And it just so happens that the were going up and down the East Coast stealing this stuff. And since I could drive an 18-wheeler, because I had done that all through my college years, I drove a tractor trailer during the summers. I took on the job, and I learned how to actually, how to steal cars and trucks. And that lasted about a year, maybe a little more than a year. And then I got transferred. I actually had gotten transferred to New York during the time. And that was a time when they were deciding that, that they might want to start an undercover operation to deal with the individuals that were fencing all the commodities that the mob were stealing. And as you had previously mentioned in your opening, they were, truck hijackings were big back then, and they were taking maybe four or five trucks a day, and they were all high-end commodities, drugs, food, and every load was worth a couple $1 million. I had a supervisor up there by the name of Guy Barada, and his idea was, because nobody had ever gotten close to the mafia, so they were thinking, well, let's see if we can get into the fences and get close to the fences and at least find out who's doing the hijackings and where they're, and recover these loads. So that's how that started.
Interesting. Yeah, and actually, I've my background is 30 years investigative experience in the private sector, not even close to anything with what you've done. However, in that capacity, I've worked with insurance carriers who insured such loads. Insured the cargo of the trucks, and we'd get called in, or I'd get called in on things that were over $1 million, or at that time $1 million plus. And so if to put that on a graph, I mean, my goodness, back in the 70s, late 70s, it was just incredible, all of these truck hikers. But yeah, it's interesting. Okay, so wow, all right. But you said something here, and I just kind of want to revisit this. Not too many agents in the bureau were undercover for any length of time. What you said, just correct me if I'm wrong, you're looking at a couple of dozen, and it would be just buy and testify, right? Kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
No long-term stuff. Okay. All right. Okay. So obviously there's a problem in the New York area, nationwide, but New York area. And I guess the story picks up when you become Donnie Brasco. Well, before you become Donnie Brasco, you're tapped to go into a kind of a training program to prepare yourself for undercover work, right? Is that?
Well, not really, because back then we didn't have any formal training. These agents that were working these various undercover cases, these were just guys that were good street guys. They were good street agents, they grew up in parts of the country, they grew up in the neighborhood, so they were just guys that knew the street, and were guys that were comfortable dealing with bad guys, and that's how they, gravitated toward it. And then, as word spreads, hey, Joe's in New York, and he's been doing some undercover, and he knows about this. Hey, Steve's out in St. Louis, and he's been working some undercover cases regarding these types of violations. So basically what happened was after a while, there was one individual by the name of Joe Yablonsky, who was a really great undercover agent, and his forte were stocks and bonds. And he decided, we ought to get all these guys week together and go over, you know, just kick around different methods of infiltration, et cetera, et cetera. But there was no training, you know, back then. And that's what we did, and we just got to know each other. And if we, you know, if we ran into a problem and we knew that, you know, that Mike out in and Chicago had this type of case, you know, you'd call Mike and say, hey, Mike, you know, this is what I got. What do you suggest? And that's how the whole program evolved from.
Wow. Okay. So it was that informal, but certainly quite effective given the talent.
Exactly. Yeah.
Man. Okay. And isn't that I just marvel at that, given the environment of today versus back then, but how you all pulled it together. You know, I mean, it's an amazing thing. Okay. And you, it's my understanding, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, you grew up in a family, you spoke Italian, you were fluent in Italian, is that correct?
No, not fluent. I wouldn't consider myself fluent. I mean,
okay.
I grew up in an Italian family, Sicilian family. My parents spoke Italian, grandparents, aunts and uncles, and I grew up in an Italian neighborhood. And I think what was beneficial to me is growing up knowing wise guys in the neighborhood, you know, because if you grow up in an Italian neighborhood, you know there's going to be gangsters in the neighborhood. So you get to learn different, you know, as growing up Italian, you know, you're told don't talk unless you're asked a question. You keep your mouth shut, you know. You don't get into anybody else's business. Stay away from those guys, you know.
You learn some street manners.
Yeah, it's all, look, it comes down to street manners, it comes down to street smarts, you know. And like I say, you know, growing up in an Italian household, you know, you don't, back in those days, you listened and that was it, you know. You spoke when you were spoken to.
Exactly. And ladies and gentlemen, we're talking with former FBI agent Joe Pistone, also known as, and you might know him, folks, as Donnie Brasco, former FBI agent who worked undercover infiltrating the Bonanno crime family, and to a lesser extent, or perhaps equal extent, the Colombo crime family, two of the largest mafia families in New York. And Mr. Pistone was an agent for almost three decades. So he's got a ton of law enforcement experience behind him. Of course, he's legendary in the law enforcement circles, and of course in Hollywood as well, as Donnie Brasco. And that's who we're speaking with right now. But Mr. Pistone, okay, so this is fantastic. So now, I mean, you, what happened next? I mean, how did you go from where you were at that time into an undercover agent that you were so successful in infiltrating the mob?
Well, you know, obviously there's some things that I can't talk about because I don't want to give away, you know,
sure,
operational things that you could use today. I mean, look, undercover hasn't changed since day one, you know, as far as how you infiltrate, how you penetrate. But, you know, you have to have a good plan. And so, you know, we knew our targets, and we knew where they hung out. And after building a legend, you know, you have to have a legend because why do they want to talk to you? Why are you there? You know, you're just hanging around to do nothing. So you have to have a legend, and you know your legend is what your criminal profession is going to be. In this instance, I picked be a jewel thief. And the reason being is that, you know, when pursuant to the Attorney General guidelines, when you're working undercover, you can't get involved in crimes of violence. You might get involved in violence to protect yourself or to protect somebody else, but you can't get involved in crimes of violence. So you have to pick a profession that doesn't lean toward, you know, a violent, toward violence. So I picked being a jewel thief because it's a nonviolent profession. Basically, it's a profession that you can operate alone. That's what I settled on. So I learned all about diamonds and precious gems. It took a while, but I did.
I heard that you actually were schooled, or you were taught or self-taught or advised for five or six months.
I went to school. Okay. I went to one of the diamond schools and learned about diamonds and precious gems. I spent time with a friendly jeweler, whose diamond guy taught me about diamonds. Besides going to this course that I took on diamonds and precious gems, because look, your legend is what makes you.
Mm-hmm.
And as anybody knows, you know, there's two things on the street. You have to maintain your credibility and your respect. And if they catch you, you know, BSing about what you say you are, then there goes your credibility, and you know, then they lose respect for you. You know, if you say you're a diamond, if you say you're a jewel thief, you better know something about precious gems and, you know, and diamonds. So,
yeah, I would hope, or you're going to be
it's a short-lived undercover operation, and if it's with the wrong people, it's a short-lived life.
Exactly. All right. And I think, I don't know how many people really out there can appreciate the fact that your dedication to your undercover assignment. I heard you quoted one time, somebody asked you if you enjoyed the undercover assignment, and your response was, "I endured it." And, that stuck with me. Okay. But I guess people really have to understand, this was not a 9-to-5 or even a, you know, 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. or whatever job. This was 24/7 for what you were undercover for.
Years. This was a 365 day a year. I mean, day job. And you're right. It's not a 9-to-5 because the idea is to get seen, to get known. Hopefully get into conversations. So, you know, bad guys, they don't work 9-to-5. They don't work Monday to Friday. So it's a 7-day a week. And, you know, because if you only see Monday to Friday, or where the hell are you Saturday and Sunday? You know, so and when you're in these type operations, you know, you divorce yourself from your, and you know, I don't mean that you go get a divorce. I mean, from your home life, from your office situation, and you're basically living out there 24/7 trying to make the infiltration. And once you make the infiltration, then you're really in 24/7.
Mm.
So you give up a lot. The undercover gives up a lot of his or her past life. Your social life now is with the group that you've infiltrated, because you're basically with them. And then, depending on who you've infiltrated, you know, you can't tell them that you're married.
Sure.
You can't tell them you have kids, because, you know, what are you going to do, bring your wife and kids around?
Yeah.
So you got to have a good backstory and to build into your legend. And it's tough. Let me say this, and I don't say this because it's me, but, I mean, I teach undercovers. I still teach undercover school. Everybody can't work undercover. It's not it's not an assignment for everybody. You got to have a different mental outlook on things, and you got to be able to focus on the task at hand and the situation, and you've got to detach yourself from the situation that you're in. So, and I always tell, I always tell everybody, to be a good undercover, you have to be a good police officer or FBI agent. But just because you are doesn't mean you're gonna be a good undercover agent. And do you understand that?
Oh, absolutely. And there's an art, as much of a science, there's an art to it. And I heard it, I've got a friend who worked undercover many years who said, you either have it or you don't.
Exactly. Maybe. That's exactly right. There's the undercover's got the next sense,
Yep.
And I always tell them is that, look, I can't teach you to be an undercover. If you have it, we can improve upon your techniques because, we've been there. But if you don't have it, nobody's going to make you one.
You can't be taught. Yeah, you can't be
exactly.
taught.
Exactly. It's not like a basketball player. You can shoot 1,000 jump shots and you can improve your shot. It doesn't work that way. If you have it, then we can improve upon it. But if you don't have it, if you don't have that mental toughness, it's not going to work.
And I'm surprised to hear you said you still teach the classes or courses undercover operations. At Quantico?
Not at Quantico. They don't. I teach with the bureau. I teach local, and I teach a lot overseas.
Gotcha. All right. And I'm just curious. And I apologize. And feel free not to answer any questions. If there's a question that you said out of line, just tell me. But when you look at a group, we'll say for the first time, are you able to pretty much identify within the group that you see, even today, that person, good, that person has it, that person, nah, not so much. Are you able to identify?
Yeah, pretty much after, probably after the second day, of interaction with them. With him or her, because there's a lot of good female undercovers. Some of them, it's the first couple conversations you have, Others it might take you, into the second day. But pretty much within a day or 2 days, we can say, you're not cut out for this.
Understood. Yeah, and that's and of course, although that may hurt that candidate initially, it's certainly going to keep that person alive because
exactly because and one of the problems is that this generation is so much into television, and the social media and everything, and they believe too much of what they. These police shows on television, and real police work is not really like that, and real undercover is not like you see in the movies or on these TV shows.
Exactly.
Undercover, you got to be a good conversationalist, and unfortunately. The generation today, how do they communicate with each other?
140 characters or... Yeah, exactly. 140 characters or less or texting, yeah.
That's exactly right. And, I've seen it where... where somebody's in one pod, somebody's in the pod right next to them, and they're texting them. Why don't you just stand up and lean over the pod and talk to him?
Exactly. Exactly.
And undercover is all about communication. And you don't communicate through Texan, I mean, as far as ingratiating yourself or infiltrating, that, you know, that's not how you, that's not how you, infiltrate an organization, by texting them or, you know, tweeting them or whatever.
And you know, it's amazing, because many people know you as Donnie Brasco from the movie. And folks, Joe Pistone is our guest. You know him as Donnie Brasco, career FBI agent, still teaching undercover work. God bless this man. Number one, because he's damn good at what he does, and has done, and he's, I'm sure has saved countless lives and brought law and order, the real kind, during his time, during his field
work.
Well,
what makes me feel good is that after, you know, you teach a class, and then about, you know, maybe 3 weeks, a couple months later, you get a call and you say, hey, man, remember, you know, remember that scenario that we did, and you told me A, B, C, and D? Well, man, I just was in the same thing, and it all came back to me, and I got myself out of it. And, I mean, that makes you feel good, you know, that, well, they're listening, and what you and what you're telling them is working.
And you know, today, in today's environment in the FBI, I don't claim to know what it's like there, but I can honestly say it makes me feel good as an American as an American, you know, that's eligible for AARP, as an American to really appreciate the fact that you're out there teaching, is still teaching, and really, that makes me feel good, and it does.
Yeah.
Give me hope.
And you know,
it gives me hope.
I will say that that the young people are, you know, they may not have all the street smarts that we have, but they're willing to learn, and they're highly intelligent. And you know, the ones that I've had in class, that they're dedicated, you know, they're dedicated to the organization, and they're dedicated, you know, they're dedicated to the country, you know. And that's what I look for, you know, somebody that's dedicated to the organization that they're working for, and dedicated, you know, to the country, and to do what's right. And what they're tasked to do.
Well, that makes me feel good hearing that from a man of your caliber and experience. So, folks, there is hope out there yet. That's for sure. Mr. Pistone, if I can go back to your time. Okay, so when you first got into, you developed your legend or your legend, well, you developed your legend as a jewel thief under the name Donnie Brasco. I'm correct in that, right? In New York City.
Yeah.
I'm just curious now. You were married at the time, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I was.
So you had to leave your wife, your family, everything, and give her a kiss and say, I don't know when I'm going to be back. And you left your life and set up shop as Donnie Brasco in New York City. And really, man, I mean, you gave it all for your job and for the task at hand. How did your wife take that? I mean, I'm just curious.
Well, you know, there are reasons, there are different reasons why guys take undercover jobs, and some of them take it for the wrong reasons. My wife knew that the reason that I was good at it, and she knew that I was fulfilling, you know, a good deed, to use, you know, lack of a better word. Now, was she happy that I was, you know, gone so long? No, but the thing is that she knew I wasn't taking undercover jobs, and I didn't sign on for this job to be away from the family. you know, to be away from the situation. It was because of, to me, it was part of my job. And an undercover operation was the only way we figured that we could get this investigation done. So, now, in these type of investigations, you know, you do move out of your residence, you get your own apartment, and your contact is very minimal with your real family because you can't be going home every night. You're living out of the apartment that you've rented. She handled it, and I think one of the reasons why she was very independent, very athletic, and what I mean by that, you know, worked out, went to the gym, was very close to our daughters, just had that type of personality. In fact, her personality would have fits the personality where she would have been a pretty good undercover agent herself. You know, after a while it gets to be tough, and you know, you just have to, when you have a chance, you just got to keep talking through it. I mean, in law enforcement, the divorce rate is high, and in undercover, in the field of undercover, the divorce rate is even higher. You just got to have two individuals that are on the same wavelength, and the individual that's not working undercover has to realize that the individual that is working undercover is doing it for a purpose, and then they believe in that purpose.
Man, mission accomplished in your case, and you know, I can only and the reason I brought that up is because there are so many documentaries out there about you, so many interviews, you know, and our audience is 99% Christian, and you know, they just wonder, okay, you know, how does that relationship even survive that?
Yeah, you gotta have strong faith too. I mean, you know, we're both Catholic, grew up Catholic, and still very active Catholics, and you know, you gotta believe in something, and that got us through.
And you believe, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I do suspect, just from everything I've read about you, you believe in good versus evil, and you were fighting on the side of good.
Definitely.
Yeah. So, but by the way, again, folks, Joe Pistone is our guest, known as Donnie Brasco. Of course, you might remember him from the movie, 1997 movie, Donnie Brasco, where Johnny Depp played his character. And of course, featured Al Pacino and, Bruno Kirby, James Russo, and many others. But
Mike
you
Madden.
Wrote a, right. Now you wrote,
Anne Heche played my wife.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Thank you for reminding me.
It was a hell of a cast, to be honest with you.
Wow. Yes.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to watch that again here. It's been a while since I've seen that. But you also have a book that you wrote, an autobiography, right? My undercover.
Well, my first book was Donnie Brasco, My Undercover Life in the Mafia. And that's what the movie was made off of. And I was fortunate enough that. That made the New York Times bestseller list. And then a few years ago, I wrote a book with Charles Brandt called Unfinished Business. And the reason for the title that this book contained information that I couldn't put in my first book because I was still in the process of testifying at trials. There were some things I couldn't reveal. And then I came out with a book called The Way of the Wise Guy. And, that's kind of, not light. Yeah, I could say lighthearted. That's kind of, how wise guys act and, you know, around the people or how wise guys, when they go to a restaurant, you know, why they always get the best table and et cetera, et cetera. And as you said, the first book, My Undercover Life in a Mafia was made into the movie Donnie Brasco with Johnny Depp. And then there was a TV show series at the CBS. We did 9 episodes, and it was called Falcone. And
that's right.
We were up against the Sopranos, and the problem was Sopranos was on HBO, and we were on CBS, and so we were, you know, we had to be kind of Lily White back in the, you know, because that was back in 2000. So, you know, TV wasn't as racy as it is today. So we had to, you know, we had to clean up the language and et cetera, et cetera. But we had, you know, we had 9 good episodes. And
I'm going to have to pull that off on Netflix. You know, I remember that contemporaneous to the time. And I was never a big Sopranos fan, honestly. But Falcone, I think I caught a few.
I mean, it was
time.
A good show. I mean, it was CBS was really hot on it, you know. But, you know, when you're doing an undercover mob show, you know, and you say, oh, darn. You know, it doesn't come out the same with a gangster saying, oh, darn, you know, so.
I hear you. And it's, you know, this is fascinating. And by the way, I have to tell you, we had Charles Brandt on last week. We interviewed him.
A great guy. I love that man.
Yeah.
A great, great person.
Oh, yeah. What an incredible interview that was. But so this is such, folks, this is so rich in history, and it's an honor, in my view, it's an honor to talk with not just a legend in the sense of an icon in law enforcement, and that's what Joe Pistone is, in my view. He's worthy of our respect and admiration because of his, what he accomplished as an FBI agent. And we're about 3 minutes away from the top of the hour break. So I don't want to get into too much more here until the other side of the break. But in the next 3 minutes, if you can just tell me this, the getting into that operation as a jewel thief, having that legend, what was your first, you know, the first step into that? That was kind of a long process, wasn't it? I mean, you had to, there was a lot of, the infiltration was not easy, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
No,
it was not,
because, you know, again, you're dealing with the mafia, even though, and, you know, you don't just walk into a bar or a restaurant and walk up to the mob guys in there and, you know, say, hey, I'm Donnie Brasco and I'm a jewel thief and I want to start thieving with you, you know. because the mob, you know, you're not from the neighborhood, nobody knows you, and, you know, that's another thing that was, that we were concerned about. There was nobody, you know, I couldn't say I was from Brooklyn, because if I was hanging out downtown and literally, then they, you know, said, well, who do you know in Brooklyn? Well, I couldn't give them a name, and vice versa for all the different boroughs. So, you know, once I start talking to people, I just had to tell them, you know, spent time in Miami, spent time in LA and cities that I knew, you know.
That was one of the things, by the way, I admired about you, because you really, and the way I understood it is you really set the stage for other FBI agents, undercover operatives. You essentially vouched for them and opened avenues.
Yeah, we can get into that later, but once I did infiltrate, how I became such a trusted individual with the Bananos, that they vouched for other other FBI undercover operations to different families. I mean, that's what was the amazing part of the operation, which it never made the movie, you know, because, you know, you're condensing the movie in an hour and, you know, maybe 2 hours, but that was the amazing part of it, that I was able to do that. So we can get into that, you know, once we come back from the break.
Yeah, because in my view, at least from what I've seen, what I've read, and of course from your book titled Donnie Brasco, My Undercover Life in the Mafia, folks, it's a great read. It's on Amazon. All of his books. Visit Joe Pistone's page on Amazon for all of his works, including the book co-authored with Charles Brandt. I think you'll find this fascinating reading. Again, our guest tonight is Joe Pistone. You'll know him as Donnie Brasco, FBI undercover agent. Spent time working for Naval Intelligence and then a lot of time in the FBI working undercover. Folks, you're listening to the Hagman and Hagman Report on the Global Star Radio Network. Give us 3 minutes. We'll be back momentarily. And while you're out, don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel and also our social networking. Stay right with us. Greenovative. Go to HagmanReport.com. Click on the link to Greenovative. What Greenovative is, it's a small company in Florida. They created something called the G-Mag Power Cell. It produces electricity by adding salt water to this unit that recharges rechargeable batteries. It's the coolest thing you'll ever see in your life. It's really neat. Really a super device. All right, you need just 2 teaspoons of ordinary table salt, a little water, but a bang, you're charging your rechargeable batteries. Super G-Mag Chargeable is affordable, it's lightweight, weighs about 8 ounces, it's durable, it's EMP proof, and it's environmentally friendly, that it is. It'll provide safe and convenient power for recharging 6 AA batteries off the grid when other power sources aren't available. Anywhere, anytime, in any weather, day or night, go to greeninnovative.com. That's greeninnovative.com. Perhaps you're a business out there, a small business. Would you like to extend the reach of your business? I bet you would. Would you like to have the same opportunities as companies such as Omaha Steaks and Pro Flowers and Casper Mattress and some of the bigger companies out there? Would you like to have that same power? Advertise on our program. Go to HagmanandHagman.com or send an email to opportunities@HagmanandHagman.com. If you go to HagmanReport.com and HagmanandHagman.com, there's a link where you can. It's a big red box. You'll see it. Click on that link and go ahead and read the benefits what we have created for you. I think it's a fabulous opportunity.
For investors, timberland has become the symbol of safety. Global tropical timber demand continues to surge as the world's population increases. The need for managed, sustainable timber production forests has never been greater. When stock markets crash, trees keep growing. Direct ownership of fully managed tropical timberland acreage is now available to accredited investors. Prime, valuable hardwood groves close to the beautiful Costa Rican border generate and maintain superior long-term wealth. Consider visiting our forest plantations. Qualified accredited investors should go to PreciousTimberProfits.com or dial 855-888-6288 for more information. Call 855-888-6288 or visit PreciousTimberProfits.com. This announcement does not constitute either an offer to sell securities or a solicitation of an offer to purchase. Offering made by prospectus only. 855-888-6288, PreciousTimberProfits.com, PreciousTimberProfits.com.